KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You may know me as a bit of a collector. I like comic books and albums and watches. I am not a collector of film prints, but there are many people who are. And my guests today, Dennis Bartok and Jeff Joseph, are here to talk about these guys. Their book is A Thousand Cuts, The Bizarre Underground World of Collectors and Dealers Who Save the Movies. First of all, guys, thanks for being here. I know Dennis from back in the days of the American Cinematheque.
Yeah, we were just talking that you knew me when my hair was long and brown, and I used to wear leather jackets and do all the introductions at the Egyptian Theater back in the 90s.
Yeah, and now what's fascinating is the kind of politic behind this. I mean, one of my favorite chapters, maybe my favorite chapter, is the way that gay men were stigmatized by the FBI and basically how Roddy McDowall was turned into kind of a traitor to this movement. Talk about that for a little bit, guy. I'll start with you, Dennis.
Well, Jeff, who is my writing partner on the project, was one of the best-known film dealers in the United States, really in the world, from the 1970s until the kind of underground film dealing and collecting world started to collapse, really probably in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And Jeff was one of 16 dealers who was indicted by the Justice Department in the mid-1970s. And of those 16 dealers, he was the youngest, and he was the only one to actually do jail time.
But it's just a crazy situation. It's almost now you're like thinking about the way people used to be prosecuted for marijuana. And
it was very strange. Well, you know Alice's restaurant, Arlo Guthrie. He's, you know, you're sitting on the Group W bench, and what are you in for? I'm in for murder and rape, and I'm in for, you know, littering. That's kind of how it was. What are you in for? You know, murder, I'm here for copyright infringement. And they all moved away from me on the bench. You know? That's kind of what it felt like, though. It was a very odd thing to be in prison for.
Even in that chapter in the book, you can just sort of see how selective the prosecution was. I mean, it was just all prosecution, a handful of cases. Then they just wanted to, like, basically send the scare through people.
They did. I mean, the rumor at the time was the FBI was embarrassed about Patty Hearst being on the lam for so long, and this was kind of an easy bust for them. But I don't know if that was really the case or not. It was a good story, though.
But I just remember reading about the time thinking, really? Because if anybody in the audience is old enough to remember, what do they call them? Oh, yeah, film prints? There used to be a time these things would be dropped off in front of a multiplex, like in the back alley. And if you want to steal one, they were very easy to get. They weighed too much for anybody to take.
They weighed too much, and let's face it, having a 35-millimeter projector is a pain in the neck, and most people did not. So it was usually safe to leave prints in the back alley, as you say.
Yeah, but so for me, and I worked in college in the movie theaters.
So the studios and the MPAA were asserting that if you owned certainly a 35-millimeter print of a major studio motion picture, and in many cases 16-millimeter prints, that you were guilty of either theft, possessing stolen property, and if you showed it even for yourself or for friends, that you were violating copyright. So the studios said that they had never sold any prints to collectors.
Which was a lie, a flat-out lie.
Clearly.
So there were circumstances where they had sold prints. So, for example, for TV syndication, so TV stations in the
pre-videotape digital
era, they used to run everything, old episodes of Gilligan's Island or F Troop,
and they
were all
on
the features.
And they're all on film.
They would be on 16-millimeter prints on a film chain, and if it broke, they would put up a little card that said, "We're experiencing technical difficulties," while a frantic guy tried to splice the 16-millimeter print back together. So those prints were sold to the TV stations, and then when that expired, you know, when their rental lease expired, they were free to dump the prints or, in certain cases, sell them to middlemen or to collectors.
They weren't really free to sell them. They had them on life of print leases, but they were free to throw them out. And that's what they essentially did. They would junk the prints. Well, I don't know. If I had something in the trash can, as far as I'm concerned, it's mine.
Yeah, and they would also junk the posters as well.
Everything.
The posters
sure.
that you couldn't legally buy got thrown out
Everybody
or given away.
Posters.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, technically, you were supposed to send this stuff back to the studios. No one ever did. No one ever did.
Well, they didn't want it because they weren't going to keep it
anyway. They were just going to throw it out anyway.
Exactly.
That's why no one did.
Yeah, so it was a very strange period. We spoke with James Boris, who was, in fact, the head of the MPAA's anti-piracy division in the mid-1970s around this time, and he described it as a very frantic period. He said there was a tremendous amount of misunderstanding and paranoia on the part of both the studios directed at collectors and on the part of collectors directed at the studios. And it was this kind of lingering cloud of paranoia that I first encountered when I started to work at the American Cinematheque in the 90s, and I came to know a lot of film collectors, people like Jeff, Ken Kramer, Mike Hyatt, others who were profiled in the book, who were still extremely worried that the studios or the federal government would come knocking on their door one day trying to seize their print collections. And it's remarkable that almost every collector we spoke to who was active in the 1970s was contacted by the FBI at some point. And that is really remarkable and unsettling that people who collected film who were just obsessed with Hollywood movies would be targeted by a very imposing, you know, I mean, it's funny, of course, right now the FBI is in the news with the election. But to think that, you know, here you are a fan of Singing in the Rain and you just want to show your 16mm print and one day you get a knock on the door and there's two guys in dark suits there saying, where did you find this print? You know, we're going to take it and we want you to sign a you know, statement of guilt, you know, promising you're never going to collect prints again. And the fact that many of the collectors were also gay men, as you said, made it, I think, even more of a culture of paranoia that kind of, you know, infected that underground world. Not all of them, of course, were gay men, you know, but enough were that I think the combination of that and the actions by the FBI and the feds really had a tremendous impact. It lasted for decades and decades. And Roddy McDowell was a collector, first and foremost. And he happened, like a lot of collectors, to be selling prints on the side from his collection so that he could buy other ones. And he was working with a guy named Ray Atherton, who was a really notorious character who's profiled in the book. And the feds had gone in, had raided Atherton's house, had found a list of films that Roddy McDowell was offering for sale. And they got a search warrant and they burst into Roddy's place and they seized all of his films. It was a tremendously scarring experience for him. Apparently he got out of collecting entirely.
He did.
And the most unsettling thing for his long-term reputation is that under pressure, he kind of rolled over and named names of other celebrities who were collecting at that time in the early 70s, including Mel Torme, the singer, Rock Hudson, and Dick Martin of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In fame. And, you know, McDowell passed away a number of years ago, but he's still referred to on the internet and, you know, in chat forums as a fink for ratting out other collectors. And that, you know, I think that's a sad judgment on McDowell. He was obviously a wonderfully gifted actor who loved Hollywood history. And he got caught in the crosshairs of the government. They sensed a big celebrity and they took him down. And it was by far the watershed moment of the so-called film busts of the 1970s that everybody remembers, the day that Roddy McDowell got busted. And it's what made everybody really go underground.
Yeah, but, you know, I think we need to explain to your audience that there was a reason that these film prints meant something, and that was it was a pre-videotape day. It was a pre-VHS DVD universe, certainly pre-home computer mostly. If you wanted to see a movie, it was either on television at 3 o'clock in the morning on Channel 5, or maybe if you lived in a college town or L.A., there were some revival theaters that might run a print someday. Or you could get a 16mm print and run it whenever you felt like it. But the only way you could run it whenever you felt like it is if you had an actual physical film print.
It's the truth. We're talking about a world that no longer exists, and then we're the worst for it, the world of film prints. A couple guys, what you call Jeff an archivist, but I think of you being as one as well, Dennis. My guests are Dennis Bartok and Jeff Joseph. They're the authors of this terrific book, 1,000 Cuts, The Bizarre Underground World of Collectors and Dealers Who Save the Movies. And as you said, Jeff, there's that point where, you know, movies only existed in your memory unless you found a way to see it projected somehow. But there's also in the book that kind of sense of magic of watching a film run projected, and it's revisited with each collector you guys talk to time and again, that love of seeing a movie unspool on a screen.
There's something magical about the film print itself. I mean, the print comes off a negative, which was in the camera when the film was shot. There maybe are some photons that bounced off that movie star and ran into that negative and are now in that film print that you're running on your projector. There is something magical about it. Film is a living, breathing artifact. It's someday going to die. I mean, all film decomposes in the long run. Digital is digital. It's zeros and ones. It's not really a solid thing. But film is.
One of the things that we actually talked about here on the show, and I talked about when Quentin Tarantino came, who has a New Beverly where they run nothing but prints, is it's been hinted that in physiological terms that something different happens to your brain chemistry when you see an image flicker.
Well, the flicker rate is different, too, for digital and for film. And Roger Ebert used to talk about that a couple times in his column, but I've never seen anyone do any science on that.
Yeah.
Is the flicker rate that's different, does that affect your brain differently? Are we seeing movies differently because the flicker rate is different? I have no idea. I'm not sure anybody does.
There has been one thing that's been proven, that people are more likely to fall asleep at a digital projection than a film projection. They're more likely to
die. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So clearly, there is something that happens to the brain chemistry.
Well, there's an emotional connection certainly between the people who collected film. It's a certain relationship between man and the movies. It's kind of one of the themes of the book. And these collectors were like an underground priesthood. And it's a kind of devotion to cinema that I don't think we will ever see again because it's so easy to access film now. You know, with a few clicks of a button, you can stream movies. You can order film on a Blu-ray from Amazon. There's so many multiple ways to experience cinema, whereas the collectors and dealers that we profiled in the book grew up in an era. I mean, Jeff, you said when you were growing up, you literally worked a paper route for almost a year to buy one single Laurel and Hardy short.
A 16-millimeter print of another fine mess, Laurel and Hardy. That's correct.
Yeah. And now many years later, he's involved with UCLA Film and Television Archive in restoring the Laurel and Hardy library. So in a way, he's come full circle after
I was running Laurel and Hardy movies in my garage for the neighborhood kids and a couple cop friends of mine, too, who I met when I was 7 years old. My next-door neighbor was a motorcycle cop. And we've stayed friends all these years, by the way. He's still around. And he and his partner used to come watch movies in their uniforms with all these kids from the neighborhood. I wish I had a photo of it. I don't, unfortunately.
And there were remarkable stories. Michael McKay, who was a former New York City area projectionist who we spoke with for the book, had a great anecdote we talk about. Where when Jaws was on its first run, he got his hands on a 35-millimeter print of the film. And it was, you know, theaters were packed. There were lines around the block in Times Square. So what he did was he had two 35-millimeter projectors at his apartment, and he pushed them up to the window, and he ran the print on the wall of the building across the street for all of his neighbors.
Well, that was a fun thing about the book is that so much of this is about, well, that priest that you talk about, but also people, the joy of sharing, the thing you're talking about,
Jeff,
the joy of sharing what you have, that people don't want to, they were driven underground and had to secrete these collections, but people don't want to.
Well, Robert Osborne, who is well known as a host for Turner Classic
and
Movies.
Figures and into that chapter about
the historian and helped catalog Rock Hudson's film collection and told us a great anecdote about how in the 1970s when the FBI started investigating collectors, that Hudson had a fake fireplace wall built in his entertainment center to hide his film vault so that when the FBI inevitably came knocking, he'd go, I don't have any film prints. But Bob Osborne talked about how when he, you know, first started getting involved in film collecting in the mid-1960s here in Los Angeles, there was a group of young film mad guys who had no money, but they would get these 16-millimeter prints of old MGM musicals. And one of his friends was a guy named Jeff Parker who danced in Ginger Rogers' Review. So he knew a lot of these stars. And this was before there was a whole sort of nostalgic revival for old Hollywood. So a lot of them were completely forgotten. And they would run their films and they would get, you know, cheap wine and spaghetti. And they would be there in the dark with this rattling 16-millimeter projector and these legendary stars watching their movies of 20 or 30 years. And it's one of the most beautiful and touching images in the entire book. And you can understand why now, even though he hasn't run any of his 16-millimeter prints in decades, Bob Osborne cannot bear to be parted from them because they meant so much to him at a certain point in his life. And they really were the reason why he fell in love with the movies.
And I also love that anecdote, too, but basically Rock Hudson didn't care about anything but Rock Hudson movies. We'll take a break. My guests are the authors of A Thousand Cuts, Dennis Bartok and Jeff Joseph. This treatment is more to come.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back. It's been a long time since anybody's spoken the words Day of the Triffid on the treatment. In fact, I don't think it's ever happened before. But it's one of the movies, and you were talking before the break, Dennis, about that love of these musicals and being able to show these things. And you, Jeff, with a Laurel and Hardy. But there's, in every one of these cases, there's a movie, one movie that somebody's obsessed with. And that almost feels like one of the reasons you guys did the book is that idea of if you peel away all the obsession and the care taken with the prints and where you're going to store them. They hear the stories that people tell about how much they love a certain movie.
Day of the Triffids is unique. It's a 1962 sci-fi film. It's actually a really good film. It really holds up well after all these years. And it is the personal obsession of an archivist and collector named Mike Hyatt, who has spent nearly 40 years of his life, tremendous amount of time and his own money to preserve this one film. And he's gone to such extremes with it that he essentially has bought all of the rights for the United States and for most of the world, which gave him access to the original camera negative of the film, which turned out was in very poor shape. They had struck a number of prints off of the original camera negative, which you're not supposed to do. But even worse, at a certain point, in an attempt to clean it, they had embedded thousands and thousands of specks of dirt in the negative, and he spent over 10 years
of
his life.
Tell the audience what that does when that dirt is embedded in the negative.
Well, the problem is if you make a print and there's dirt embedded in the negative, it then shows up as
white
spots, white specks, while you're watching the film, and it essentially creates a barrier, a psychological barrier. It takes you out of the experience of watching the movie. It's if there's, you know, static on the soundtrack or lines on the screen, you become aware of those and you're no longer drawn into the story and the characters and the emotion. So he spent over 10 years of his life huddled over a bench with a jeweler's loop and a little needle plucking somewhere between 20 and 30,000 specks of dirt out of the camera negative by hand. That devotion, even among the world of collectors and archivists, sort of Mike and Day of the Triffids stands alone. And it's almost like Don Quixote. You know, it's risen to a whole other epic level. But this was a film that was independently produced, and it slipped through the cracks. And if there were no Mike Hyatt there to try and save this movie, it wouldn't be saved.
Or it would exist in very poor quality, perhaps. You know, old VHS tapes, and that's about it.
Now, ironically, he's having the film digitally scanned in 4K, and he's
going to
redo all of the work that he spent years and years doing. So
he's not done yet.
Yeah. I don't know that he will ever be done with it. Because
the work
it has
done, by
become
the way, it looks
his
spectacularly
great
good. I mean, he's doing excellent work with it, but he's not done yet, no.
No, and it looks amazing. And he's done a great service to the film and to film lovers by saving this movie. There's another great example, Wes Shank, who was a East Coast area collector in the late 1960s, discovered the 4 minutes of missing footage from the original 1933 King Kong. And it includes the footage of Kong the ape sort of toying erotically with Fay Wray's dress, stomping and even chewing on several natives. And it's footage that had been censored from the film in the late 1930s. And they cut it out of the original negative. So it was gone and had been missing for, you know, nearly 40 years. And another dealer out of the blue sent him a package one day because Wes used to offer trailers for sale and said, look, I've got this rare footage from King Kong. And if you want it, just send me a bunch of these trailers. Ironically, one of them was for King Kong versus Godzilla, another Kong film. And Wes cracked open the footage. And when he talks about it, I compared it in the book to when Howard Carter peered into King Tutankhamun's tomb. It's that breathless sense of excitement of discovering something rare and wonderful and truly lost. And in his case, Wes actually made copies of that footage, which then were distributed among private collectors for years. And he eventually turned it over essentially free of charge to the studio that owned the film and asked him, you didn't insist on getting paid for it? I mean, you know, what price tag would you put on that lost footage? He said, you know what? It didn't belong to me. I didn't make the movie. It belonged to everybody who loved King Kong, and I'd rather that they get to see the film the way it was originally meant to be seen. And there is an altruistic love. I mean, a lot of collectors can be incredibly paranoid, secretive, obsessive. Collecting is a kind of madness. But there is a real childlike love for cinema, and I think a moral obligation. Again, Mike Hyatt, who saved Day of the Triffids, talks about his sense of obligation to preserve these movies for other generations the way they were meant to be seen. And I think in the end, that's what collectors do best of all.
The book is called The Bizarre Underground World of Collectors and Dealers Who Save the Movies. But I think A Thousand Cuts is what you're really saying, Dennis. It's a book about obsession. And an obsession that really is about wanting to expose something that you love to everybody. And I guess, again, that's what I end up responding to in the book. And I just wonder, because there is some mention towards the end of the book of maybe another generation of collectors and archivists coming around. But it's a world that's dying out, really. And that's – I wonder why now for the book.
Well, it's because Jeff and I saw the underground world of film collecting and film dealing disappearing so quickly. There's a sort of perfect storm.
It really has been over the last 15 years.
Oh, yes.
Really, the last 10 to 15 years, it's accelerated at such a fast pace. Ironically, one of the most fascinating collectors in the book, Ronnie James, who has a massive private television collection, talks about the theory of creative destruction, which was posited in the 1940s by a theorist named Joseph Schumpeter, which says that new technology supplants old technology, and it also wipes out the way of life associated with that. So when the electric light came in the late 19th century, it wiped out the whaling industry, but also the way of life and all of the villages and the culture that was associated
and
with
the
whaling.
The industry and the culture. Yes.
So that's what's happened in the transition from analog film to digital filmmaking and distribution. So the collectors are getting older. They're retiring and or dying out. Eight of the collectors who were profiled in the book have since passed away in the time between when we interviewed them and the book came out.
Is that true? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, Ken Kramer, Mike Vraney of Something Weird Video, Evan Foreman.
Al Beardsley,
a number of them profiled in the book have passed away. It's really tragic how fast they're going. The prints themselves are succumbing to either vinegar syndrome or they're fading. All film will decay. Any film print, even if you make it today under the very best circumstances on the best stock and you store it perfectly, it has a shelf life of maybe 125 to 150 years, and a lot of the older prints far less. So all film is rapidly decaying. And the studios are no longer making any new prints. So there's no more product to feed that obsessive collector underground. So that's this sort of perfect storm. You know, we're going to continue to have book collectors, comic book collectors, record collectors like myself for decades to come. But we really are looking at the end of film collecting.
Because it's funny. I know you guys have seen the Keanu Reeves documentary. And at one point, David Fincher, being interviewed, he said, well, look at my office. I have 3/4 inch. I have 1/2 inch. I have 1 inch. I have that. I have all these formats. I have nothing to play them on. The only thing I can still play is film.
Hold up a piece of film from 100 years ago. You have a magnifying glass. You can still see the image. It's right there. You have a flashlight. You can project it onto the wall. It's a very low-tech way of looking at things, but anybody can look at a piece of film and see what it is. Try doing that with a floppy disk from a few years ago.
I was at the Egyptian Theater just before I came over here for this interview, and we were testing out our newly retrofitted nitrate screening capabilities in the projection booth, and we showed a beautiful 35mm black and white nitrate short from the early 1940s of, you know, in Florida, I think it might be Coral Gables or down there, where they would have the underwater mermaids. And it was stunning. The print was in such beautiful, beautiful condition. And, you know, that nitrate film stock was made with a tremendous amount of silver in it. So it has a really particular sheen, especially in black and white.
A glow, kind of a soft glow to it, yeah.
And you really feel like you are peering through a kind of window into a bygone era when you see these original prints. And there is something very bittersweet and almost
magical.
Magical and you know, you start to anthropomorphize these, you know, inanimate objects. But, you know, especially as the collectors would get older and they would look at these prints that were starting to fade and they would have scratches and splices, and they are like human beings. They show the ravages of time, and eventually, like us, all of those film prints will die. And I think it's because we saw the collectors dying and the prints dying at the same time that we felt we really had to talk to the collectors and dealers while they were still around to share their stories and kind of capture a portrait of this very bizarre but very fascinating underground world.
How long had the book been in the discussion phase before you guys sat down
about
to write?
About 5 years between Dennis and I. And my late wife, Lauren, and I did a lot of research back in the 80s. We were talking about doing it, too. So it's been in the pipeline for a long time, one way or the other.
Oh, gosh. So what brought it to push to fruition?
Dennis and I were looking for a project to do together, and we both knew some of the same people, and you know, we decided to do this.
I went up to interview Jeff at his warehouse in Palmdale, Lancaster area, and he used to have an incredible setup there with a curved silver screen and dual interlock projection. And he had gotten rid of everything. He had ripped out the silver screen. He had ripped out the projectors. He had recently sold his entire film collection to the Packard Humanities Institute. And we were walking through the ghostly shell of his former office screening room. And that was, I think, really what kind of, you know, sparked the first, you know, sparks in my brain that we should try and document this subculture before it disappeared completely.
And finally, that's what the book really is to me. It's a book about the community. I mean, each of these, the amount of care and attention and the sheer affection for the medium that's found in each one of these chapters. And I just wonder if you guys got pleasure from just being able to communicate that to people.
Well, I know that Jeff and I mean, Jeff has lived with this for, you know, his entire adult life, and he went to prison for it. So, you know, it can't have been an easy experience.
It's been bittersweet in a way. I mean, some of these people I recontacted after many years, I hadn't talked to in ages myself. I mean, Evan Foreman, I'm so glad we got a hold of. He was, what, in his 90s when we finally spoke to him?
Yeah, and he died shortly after we spoke with him.
I was shocked that he was still around. I was shocked he was willing to speak to us. It was terrific, though. I'm glad we did.
Yeah, we did an event at the Egyptian Theater a couple of weeks back, and we had a number of the collectors come up and talk. And I think they were really happy that finally that they got a chance to
be public,
to come out of the shadows and to be seen as heroes and not the villains, which is how they were portrayed for a number of years.
Or crazy people.
You know, that they were an integral part of trying to preserve these little bits of celluloid before they vanished forever.
We're out of time. I can't thank you guys enough for doing this. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Elvis.
Completely my pleasure. My guests are Dennis Bartok and Jeff Joseph, the authors of 1,000 Cuts, the bizarre underground world of collectors and dealers who saved the movies. And they did. Our recording engineer who's saving me here today at NPR West is Leo DeLagula. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. Let's keep the movies alive. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.